house a ton of cars up there because it's a huge parking lot. But we understand from Dick Wilson that apparently the armory people in Sacramento have nixed that idea. So we're going to see if we can add some political pressure. So that's kind of a recap of what happened.
How long were you and Ed on the phone there?
Oh, probably a good 20 to 30 minutes.
And was this like one of these conference calls, or was it just the two of you?
No, he just gave me a call. I guess he had heard somewhere that I was still trying to find a safe and legal place for vehicle housed at the minimum, and hopefully homeless people at the maximum, so that they wouldn't be intimidated by tickets. I let him know that about 406 calls for service, basically complaint-driven, had happened in Santa Cruz since, I guess, early June, and I think 49 tickets had been issued. We talked also about reducing the fine, and Ed had the idea of putting it on a graduated scale, where maybe the first time it's $1, the second time it raises it to $5, the third time up to $15, and so forth, and because he felt there should be some incentive on the other side. But so I told him I was going to be sending a letter from the homeless working group that will go out tomorrow that basically gives them some options. One, to repeal sections A and B of the camping ban to decriminalize sleeping, or two, establish safe sleeping zones either at the, one of the city-owned parking lots, or if we can find a business parking lot that would be available, or three, look at working with Fred Keeley, who had indicated at one point in time that he would be willing to move this issue forward on the armory, and four, to look at the baseball field that Michael Hernandez had suggested at the council meetings when he was on the council. So kind of a four-step optional program to try to get these folks to move off the dime.
Well, I know that we talked earlier about following up on a fifth alternative, which is the proposal by Christopher Crone at the June 28th 1 a.m. council session where...
Yes, but I apologize for not bringing that up. You're very true.
Right, no, I think you're doing fine. I just wanted to mention it now.
Yeah, because what we're doing in the letter is also, I mentioned that to Ed Porter, that and he said that he would follow up as well once he got my letter, that the council had directed City Manager Dick Wilson to work with city staff and Ken Cole from the Homeless Resource Center to see what options were available in private parking lots throughout the city. And apparently, from what we've learned from Ken Cole, is that that's never been followed up on. So we're going to see if we can put some pressure on that area as well.
I know that you found through preliminary discussions with a few parking lot people that their preference was to use city parking lots, and then if it worked, perhaps they could join on, but that they were reluctant to do it themselves. And in fact, they wondered why the city, which I don't know if the city has more parking lots than private parking lots. I think there actually are. There's Gateway's parking lot, and there's a number of parking lots down there, including, of course, the larger one at Zanotto's. And there are several, there are numerous private-owned parking lots, I think, perhaps, that haven't been investigated. But the city does have large parking lots downtown, and conceivably people could at least park their vehicles. We're not necessarily talking about setting up tents, though I don't see why people who don't have vehicles should not be allowed to sleep at night as well, you know, somewhere.
Well, Ed Porter and I also talked about the roof of Lot 10, the River Street lot, and I explained to him that we had been advised by the city's fire chief that apparently because of the fact that there is no sprinkler systems, there's a state fire code violation if you allow vehicle housed people to use that lot overnight. But Ed said he was going to do some checking on that. I also had mentioned to him that some of the problems with the lots that now that I've done a little bit further investigation is that we're kind of assuming that after about 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, those lots are not used. But apparently that's not the case. The lots around the Nickelodeon Theater are being used until after midnight because of the movie. The lots like Zanotto's are being used because of the River Street theater there, and they're not available until after midnight. The dot-comers are upset because they have their people working all types of hours and shifts, and so consequently they were afraid of conflict between their employees and the homeless people. I don't know what the big deal was, but I guess they were. So I explained all that to Ed, and but again agreed to try to see what we could do, and maybe he and Christopher and I and you and others can sit down at the table and kind of craft a proposal that would work and see where we can find the appropriate facilities to make it work.
When I spoke to Christopher Crone on Wednesday, I believe it was, or maybe Tuesday, I guess it was, he told me we talked for an hour with Becky Johnson there in part. He said he wanted to wanted to see you make a gesture of good faith to get something done in terms of approaching business people. And of course, you and I then immediately got on the phone to Ken Cole and then called Christopher Crone. The next thing I knew, the next day, when the agenda for this upcoming Tuesday City Council meeting was formed on the 12th, he was reproaching me for, in some way, misrepresenting him, and said, Crone said he would call you back and talk to you, but he didn't want to talk to me. And I want to know, has Crone reached you yet?
No, but in his voicemail message you left me, which I saved for you, by the way, so you could hear it in its entirety, he had indicated he was going to be sending me an email. And as of Friday at about 6 o'clock when I left the office, 5:30, whatever it was, I had not received an email from Christopher, which was going to outline what he felt the city would be willing to do.
I think it's... go ahead.
And I would argue with Christopher that the business community has already taken what I think is an unprecedented step of supporting safe and legal places for homeless people to sleep. And we had some ideas. The city eventually punted on the whole issue, as you recall. So... you know, I think that if he's looking for a good faith effort, that's already happened as of March of last year, and again reinforced in June and July and August.
March of this year, right. Go ahead.
Anyway, I think you're picking up here on my cell phone.
Oh, well, we can still hear you. I just, a couple more quick things before you go, or?
Okay, go ahead.
So I guess another concern I have is that these council members not kind of split us up, because we've invited them to come to the homeless working group meeting. Emily Riley was supposed to come. Did she ever get in touch with you and contact you?
The story I got was that some council business was just at her buried, and that she did not believe that she was going to make it, nor did she show up.
And the story I heard from her was that she just had too much work at the bakery, so maybe she better get her story straight, or maybe there was a real change. I don't know. I myself become very skeptical about these council members over the years. They seem willing to try to engage in these one-to-one, you know, trust me diplomatic efforts, but when it comes to facing a group of people and actually thrashing something out, they don't want to be there and do it. I guess I'd like to see that happening as well.
If Christopher actually does get in touch with me and says he wants to meet, that will be the thrust of my meeting, is that let's sit down with all the players, representatives from the homeless community, representatives from the service providers, the city, business community, and so forth, to see what we can craft out. Because again, we've got another cold winter. It's been extraordinarily cold. We've already had one death because of people being exposed to the elements, and we know from the homeless study that we've got about 3,000 in our county, about 1,000 of them in Santa Cruz alone. Probably 800 of them are living in vehicles. This issue can't just sit and die. It's got to move forward.
Right. I don't know. I think that's probably an overestimate of the number of people in vehicles, or an underestimate of the number of people in the city, but there's definitely a real problem out there.
Yeah.
And you have many, many people with no legal places to sleep, and council members sitting on their hands, and the last city council meeting of the year coming up on December 12th. I guess what I heard from David Silva today was that Ed Porter might be willing to introduce something at the January session, which of course wouldn't make it anywhere till the February session, you know, because they have a month delay, even if they pass it in two sessions, if we're talking about legal changes.
Yep.
But I guess my concern is to see something done right now at this focal point when people are to some extent aware of homeless people because of the media, because of the holiday season, because of the weather, you know? And I think that that's why talk about delaying this, to me, really means denying it, so to speak. And maybe it doesn't. Maybe they do need more time, but you know, you've been on this for a year, and you've seen them, you know, you've seen this process happen a year ago. I don't see that Ed Porter is going to get any new information that he didn't have already. What do you think?
Well, I would somewhat agree with you, Robert.
Well, I hope I'll see you at the council meeting at 7 o'clock on Monday. I think there's going to be a large protest starting at 6 of the town clock, and then the 6:30... I'm sorry, on Tuesday. They're all the same. Yeah, Tuesday on the 12th. Sorry about that, listeners. And we're talking to Michael Schmidt, Area Chamber of Commerce CEO, who's actually acting in his capacity as a private citizen. Is that true, Michael?
You got it.
Anything else you want to add? Any season greetings?
Best to you and all of yours and your listeners, and happy holidays. And hopefully this time next year we can say, God, we got this issue resolved. We've moved forward. We've got some safe places for the homeless to sleep, and we've actually reduced the number of homeless in our community.
Wow. Thank you.
But at this moment, unfortunately, that's not likely to be the case. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. You can, of course, be a part of this movement to end the sleeping ban. You can give a call right now to City Hall at 420-5017. You can join the mass protest at City Council at 6 o'clock on December 12th. That's in 2 days, Tuesday afternoon and evening. There should be some hot soup there. I'm going to see if I can round up some. And the City Council starts at 7, but there'll be a kind of a rally at 6. Bring a bathrobe, bring a nightgown, bring a candle, bring a nightcap, bring a teddy bear, whatever. And then bring a blanket. David Silva is beginning, I'm told, his fast again. That is to say, the round of fasting, which people are doing in conjunction to encourage the City Council to be aware that every night, that let's say an individual stays up all night in order to kind of in solidarity with the homeless people, because that's what a homeless person is expected to do under the sleeping ban. It's illegal to sleep. You have to stay awake between 11 and 8:30 in the morning on pain of a $54 fine. City Council member is phoned the next day and told, hey, I stayed awake all night. I want you to know I don't appreciate that condition. I'm doing it myself, and I don't appreciate that other people have to do it because you are not taking action to end the sleeping ban. And so that's one thing you can do. If you want to be a part of that, you can call David Silva at 429-5284, but ask for David specifically, and he will sign you up and give you a place there. If you want to join the City Council Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In, you can give a call to Bernard Klitzner, 476-6734, or 475-1905, or just 423-HUFF, if all these numbers are confusing you. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, how's it going, Robert?
Good. Who's it?
Listening to the show there.
Oh, good.
And I listened to a lot of the traffic, a lot of the dispatch traffic for the local PD, as well as the fire and the ambulance. But I've noticed in the last month and a half, the latter part of the fall into the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That the number of calls for homeless campers have gone down.
Excellent.
So that's, I guess, encouraging, and that's both on the sheriff and the police band.
Wow.
And there's not really like during the summer, mm-hmm. the later parts of the summer when a lot of the tourists start to drop off, there's a spike in just officers just stumbling across, like they'll say out with one at such and such an area instead of a general address, because they're delivering back in the back of somebody kind of actually looking for people. But I don't even hear any more of that.
Hmm.
So that would be an encouraging thing, because I work at a place that deals with tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dealt with a couple of foreign in from Sweden or Norway, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in and they were dead tired. You know, they were tired.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, you know, got woken up. Or he started the day, he goes, no, we just got really woken up. I said, oh, where was that at? And he goes, up at the campus. Up around the outskirts of the campus. They just pulled up, and what they do in Norway, and, you know, just lay and catch your sleep. And they even encourage, there's a commercial that encourages people to do this, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you listen to much big frequency radio, but there's actually a commercial that they go power nap, you know, take a power nap. And how's that going to affect those people? That's when it's going to hit those individuals, is when they get a cop tapping on their window when they're off on the side of the road somewhere taking a little power nap because they've been driving for hours.
Yeah, it's also a matter of safety.
And then they're going to have to go through the embarrassment of having to explain that to the officer.
Right, and to the judge, unless they want to avoid a ticket and a fine.
That's correct. And if we could bring it to these people, and there is a mixed concern that I have with some of the homeless, is that they do move into an area that's already trashed, or they trash an area that they find, and or then they leave it trashed, and the next person got to come deal with it trashed. But even intervention from the occupants of the adjacent properties, you know, nudge and put out a few bags. If the bags are full, and put somewhere out of sight or where they can be dealt with, then you probably got a good homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got the wee folk. But if you go back that way, say it's your walking area at night, that your path of where you walk is there at night, which I've actually heard people argue at council meetings in the past, that I go this path and I used to take my daughter on this path and I won't take her on this path anymore because there's so much garbage left by the homeless. You know, not the kids, not the neighbor kids partying, you know. It wouldn't be the neighbor kids partying. It wouldn't be, you know. It's got to be the homeless. And yeah, if we can break that.
Well, I've always said that, you know, a more reasonable deal with ticketing campsites or ticketing people who are leaving a mess is to ticket them for the mess they leave.
Oh, absolutely.
And to put into
effect. Call it a domestic mess ticket.
Yeah, I mean, and there are those who say, well, we can't prove that they made the mess. The thing to do is to simply write a section of the law which states if you are sleeping in an area within 10 feet there's, you know, debris and garbage, that you can be cited for it whether you put it there or not.
Here's what a ranger once said when I was involved with a group up behind the the government services, or the county government services building up by the creek there. There's campsites that pop up. And one of the officers came back. Well, first we saw the first alarm guy in the bushes shining lights, and then they left. And they brought back a cop, an officer. And the officer said, you know, I know that a lot of this mess is your guys'. And to the guys that were staying there, he could obviously tell I was just visiting the place. And he goes, because I don't even see an attempt to keep things stacked up in one place. He goes, if I could look and see right now that there was a spot where you guys kept your individual garbage, then I'd be more likely to believe that all this mess isn't yours. Mm. If you show an effort to keep your area policed, which is the garbage that you created while you were there that you hauled in, is in a spot where you can conveniently haul it out.
Well, yeah, I all the talk about garbage is, to me, largely garbage because, I mean, it's true, but,
yeah, but it's
you know,
a scapegoat issue. I mean,
it's a scapegoat
downtown,
issue.
Downtown, they lost their scapegoat because the homeless are being, have phase, whatever phase they're on right now, is complete, and they have not a gap tooth on the mall. Or, pardon me, they do have a gap on the mall, that's right, but they don't have a natural gap where you can see air through anymore. You can't be within 50 feet of a building anymore.
You can't be within 50 feet of an ATM or 10 feet of a building. It's
true. You can't stand in the middle of the street on the yellow line and lean either way and you're busted.
Well, you can't sit within 10 feet of a building, and I guess if you're at Zachary's, it's okay to sit in the median.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your calling in, caller. Anything more you want to add?
Oh man, I'm exhausted on that.
Okay.
You did cover quite a bit today though, and you know what, Robert? That last caller that says that, you know, they got some issues with you, and they got some issues with people that you don't have issues with.
Mm-hmm.
But you are constant, Robert. You're a very constant individual.
I'm one of those consistent.
One thing
types.
I can always count on you doing is rallying around the food, Robert.
Well.
You do that, and there have been people that have voiced about that. I've always been interested to see like when you're going to pull some time aside to let people like rebuttal you or.
Sure.
Pull up something you can rebuttal on that. I'd like to see your stand on that.
I'm waiting for them to call in.
All right. I look forward to listening to that one.
Thanks a lot.
I'd record that one myself.
All right.
All right, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And lines are once more open, 427-3772. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norse, your host for this 2.5 hours until 1:30 every Sunday. I happen to have here the Green Party platform, State Green Party platform on housing, and I'm going to read it. It's good because we have two Greens, so-called Greens. Well, we have a Green, Fitzmaurice is a Green, he's our mayor, and a Green Party endorsed candidate, Ed Porter. And I mentioned this to caller Bernard, who's doing one of us working to do the City Hall Sleepers Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In next week, which I invite people to join, to spend an hour in the City Council offices. But Bernard's concerned, as many of us are, about the Green Party accountability for these folks. Here's the platform, the housing platform. Housing is one of the basic necessities of life, yet too many households can no longer afford adequate shelter. Rents have soared due to real estate speculation. One out of five renters pay more than 50% of their income for housing. Fewer than one in 10 renters can afford to buy a median-priced house in the area where they live. In an era of deregulation, tenants have had few legal protections, and those that exist have begun to be eroded. Rent control and eviction protection for tenants does not exist in most jurisdictions, and where it does, it is usually inadequate and under attack. Landlords who, in violation of housing code requirements, fail to keep their property in habitable condition are tolerated or at most given slaps on the wrist. Housing discrimination remains rampant among people of color, immigrants, disabled, single people, gays and lesbians, and families with children. It is conservatively estimated that 1 million people are homeless, very conservative. The 20-year decline in real wages for workers is also a major contribution to the current crisis in housing availability and affordability. In addition, certain laws have also contributed to the problems of housing supply and cost, and are in some cases consciously used to exclude households with lower incomes from higher income communities. Areas of local law that should be revisited include ordinances that prohibit a shift toward co-housing, land use plans that provide excessive amounts of land for industrial and commercial use, and inflexible building codes that prevent alternative, often less expensive construction approaches that still meet health and safety requirements. The Green Party recognizes housing as a human right and will work toward eliminating economic and other forms of discrimination in the construction and use of housing through renters' rights. Protect tenants with rent control laws, including vacancy control. Repeal California's Costa-Hawkins bill, which outlawed vacancy control regulations. What that means is that any time that a vacancy is created under the new state legislature law, it's been around for about 5 years, actually, then the landlords can raise the rent, regardless of rent control laws. That law should be eliminated. Prevent evictions without just cause. Restrict owner move-in evictions of long-term tenants, the elderly, and disabled persons. Crack down on landlords who refuse to maintain their properties in habitable condition or who engage in illegal evictions with hefty fines and, in extreme cases, jail terms. Have you heard Tim Fitzmaurice proposing any of this other than dumping hundreds of Hispanic tenants in the Dolphin and Lee project, which, by the way, the Lee project is now coming up again on the closed agenda this Tuesday at City Council, not where you'll be able to talk about it. Though, in fact, if you want, you can, if you're very, very dedicated, go down at 1:30 in the morning, Tuesday afternoon to the City Council, and right before they close the session, you'll be allowed 3 minutes to speak to the item on the agenda, or perhaps less, depending on the temperament of Mayor Fitzmaurice. But as I've said, around the renters' rights issue of the Green Party platform, which I'm reading, I haven't heard our Fitzmaurice city council person, now mayor, speak up in any way in terms of any meaningful legislation around rent control or even trying at a state level to end the Costa-Hawkins bill. Maybe he did and I wasn't watching. Increase affordable housing supply. Enforce the law against illegal hotel conversions. Use vacant housing, whether it closed military bases or housing being kept off the market by speculators or landlords delinquent in taxes, to shelter the homeless. Now, it was proposed this summer that by Hernandez that a building be purchased, and there's numerous examples of seaside company housing that was deteriorated that could have been used to house the homeless. What's going to happen on December 15th, perhaps the 18th, the Rex Court property, the houses that are on there, will be demolished so that Mercy Charity's pet project, the Dolphin Lee project, can be built with less housing than originally existed for the people who were living there. Housing that it will be inaccessible to some of those people, and no alternate housing proposed for them. Build, and that's Mayor Fitzmaurice's shining gem of a proposal. It's been his baby. He's been carrying that every step of the way, even to the extent of making sure that the tenants who are in a majority could not meet in the committee funded by the city, the Relocation Advisory Committee, 2 months in a row this summer, and then having the committee disbanded. That's your democratic process, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice. Again, continuing with the Green Party platform, build human-scale low-income housing as does Habitat for Humanity. Nothing has been built. Tim hasn't voted to build anything. Create a rent subsidy program for the poor. Now, it's true that Tim has proposed that a landlord be given a subsidy to beef up his property down there in the beach flats so that he can then lower the rent raises for a property which he has purchased. There's been some discussion of that at a property at Riverside and Lee Brandt And I don't have too much information on that, how that's going. When I spoke to Elizabeth Vogel about that issue, she was saying to me, why are you so concerned, in essence, about Mercy Charity's housing when private landlords are ripping off people with these high rent increases? And, of course, I'm concerned about both. Not one or the other, but both. Pursue more efficient use of our existing housing supplies, such as home sharing and cooperative conversions of existing dwellings. Fair housing laws. Strengthen and enforce fair housing laws against discrimination based on race, sex, familial status, children, marital status, disability, and sexual orientation. Fully fund the Fair Employment and Housing Commission and provide generous government funding to nonprofit organizations engaged in fair housing monitoring and enforcement. Insist that architectural review boards and planning commissions represent the concerns of citizens rather than the concerns of economic segments of the community. And there's a section on reform of the zoning and building codes, which I won't read right now, although they're interesting. But I'll skip directly to the key section that most of us are interested in who follow this show, homelessness. Homeless people have the right to full acknowledgement of their human dignity and a voice in the decisions that affect them. Homelessness reflects an area of total failure in our society. Today, homeless people are hounded, threatened, and often cannot obtain badly needed services. Though affordable housing could help alleviate the problem of homelessness, the homeless have needs that go beyond housing. The Green Party calls for measures to help the homeless. Expand community-based services for the homeless and make them more readily available. Repeal all laws that criminalize any facet of homelessness or helping the homeless. Abolish anti-sleeping laws, especially in areas which don't have adequate open space, shelter, or sleeping areas for the homeless. Strictly enforce all laws that are designed to provide for the homeless, such as the laws that require the opening of the National Guard armories to the homeless during inclement weather. Allow the homeless to take part in decisions about long and short-term solutions to their situation. And that's something that Mayor Sugar and Tim Fitzmaurice did absolutely nothing about this summer, in spite of the recommendations of the Homeless Issues Task Force, the $10,000 Homeless Issues Task Force. They didn't allow any meaningful public discussion of those things, and then when they voted on them, they did not provide for homeless input into police training or homeless input in any other aspects of the homeless situation. Strengthen and increase funding of mental health and drug rehabilitation systems. This is from the Green Party platform. It's the platform that Tim Fitzmaurice is walking all over while he's mayor. It was interesting. On Friday in the morning, I was at the City Council Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In, sitting in at the office of the... I was alone there. And I happened to see some folks come and grab this. It was actually Martine, the assistant city manager. He took the big barrel of food that was sitting inside the city offices, as a barrel of kind of canned and packaged food, and took it over to Second Harvest to give to their food drive. And I remembered that 2 days before, a homeless man, who I'm about to play an interview with, a brief interview with, WC his name is, tried to take a bit of food from this barrel, and he was told he couldn't do that, because it was for Second Harvest, not for the homeless, or not for homeless people directly. And this, of course, is the big kicker with all these charities, and the big fly in the ointment, turd in the punch bowl, you know, rat in the burger, for the proposals about don't give your money to the homeless, give them to charities who will help find the best ways to get shelter and food to homeless people. Most of the money doesn't get there. And that which does under restrictions that are often dehumanizing, defeat the purpose of the contribution, and are so delayed as to be ineffective. So I went over to the Civic Auditorium across the street from City Hall, where Mayor Fitzmaurice was presiding over a great ceremony being videoed by the media about what a wonderful humanitarian he is and the city of Santa Cruz is for this incredible Second Harvest and all the food they're getting. And of course, I stood right behind the mayor with my sign, End the Sleeping Ban. Of course, what we really needed were 30 people shouting questions at the mayor. What about the sleeping ban, mayor? What percentage of this food goes directly to the homeless and things of that sort? But, of course, it's hard to know when these events actually happen. But it's really useful to have people at City Hall, because not only can you be sitting in there, but you can be available to go to these other kind of branch out from there to do these other events. So I do encourage you, give a call to 423-HUFF. Or give a call to Bernard at one of his two phone numbers, and you can get those numbers from 423-HUFF if you want to be a part of the City Hall teach-in and sit-in. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and here's the interview I promised you.
Challenged and disabled, and not to get into the old disability 101 rag, but if the challenged and disabled are suffering because of it, and there's a heck of a lot of psychological disabled homeless out there, you could go to the federal courts under the ADA and sue the city government of Santa Cruz to accord reasonable accommodation of one parking lot.
You need facility of that.
Of course. And that's what it's called, ADA.
Yes, well, I'm always trying to bring it up.
Well, it's beginning to sound like Silicon Valley and the alphabet soup is at Washington, D.C.
Now, you, as the other day when you were with us in the offices of the city council, kind of trying to press the case to end the sleeping ban.
Yeah, that's what happens when you use a voice-activated tape recorder. Beware all potential reporters. However, you do catch the gist. An interesting point made by WC was that folks who are disabled have a legitimate gripe against how the city and other authorities are treating homeless people in violation of the homeless federally mandated protections for folks with disabilities. So, Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper published in San Francisco, actually one of two, there's also a Street Sheet up there, has come out with a new issue. We don't have too many of them, but we have some. It's available for sale by homeless vendors, and it costs a dollar to the average person on the street. That's a suggested, I'd say the average person who buys it. Homeless vendors get it free, at least the first 10 issues. We really have a very limited number of these papers this week, or I should say this month, because there was a small print run. On the front cover is a story by Peter Maron, who's kind of a writer and philosopher and homeless activist in Santa Barbara. And he has a poem, too, and I'm going to read you the poem, The Coats, Boston, by Peter Maron. Let each man with two coats explain to the mirror why God should not punish him while others have none. Freezing now and snow falling, and those without coats huddled on city corners or crumpled in doorways or standing hands out at the concert hall door, didn't they fight your wars? Didn't they pave your roads? Didn't they tend you gently when injured at the hospital you ached for the human touch? Night after night they die. Night after terrible night they sigh themselves away in dumpsters and burnt buildings and the back seats of junk cars on the far edge of your cities. They crowd your bedrooms in the dark. They huddle under your silk sheets. Unseen, they bend over each sleeper and touch with bloodied palms this face, that breast, given the task by a God who wants no one to forget. When at night you examine yourself, there they are in the mirror, their pale faces, the sky, their tears, the shimmering stars, their trembling arms extended. Ah, you know whose arms those are. That's a poem by Peter Maron in the December issue of Street Spirit called The Coats. And there's lots of other good stuff in this issue, including an article by Becky Johnson, local writer, and some stuff from Berkeley by Nancy Delaney, Homeless Youth Survive the Streets and Create a New Life Helping Others. Elena Smith of Santa Cruz has an article in this issue as well. Both the Santa Cruz articles are on page 3. There's an article about a war of attrition between renters and landlords, about Berkeley Free Clothes Store. And there's an article attacking the Oakland eviction game, a rigged game in a lawless town, and Oakland landlords ignore the law as they master the art of eviction for profit. and numerous bits of poetry. Here's an article by a poem by Marjorie Sherman called No Room at the Inn. There was no room at the inn. He walks the streets, blanket thrown over his shoulder, feet dirty and bare. He seeks no inn. He seeks no smile. He raises his hand to strike, but it never falls. There is nothing to strike, for there is nothing. Nothing in garbage pails, maybe a street corner cup of coffee. The only room for him is on the street, and he passes as nothing. Yet he is striking in his angry misery. He is always there, always searching. Who will find him a place to stay? Yet he would not stay. He will never stop at the inn. A story called No Room at the Inn, a poem by Margaret Sherman. All from this issue of Street Spirit. Oh, here's a fine article about two activists in Santa Barbara who gave up their home every night to go down and sleep in front of the city center to protest the sleeping ban in Santa Barbara, in San Diego, a city that I visited 3 years ago. That's Ann and Forrest Curo. They also co-edit a newspaper down there called Street Light. And, well, there's just a lot of good stuff in this paper. I suggest you check it out. And if you can't find a copy of it, give a call to HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF. We've been given some encouragement recently, those of us concerned about the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, by what's happened up in Portland, Oregon. And there's a whole issue of the Portland, Oregon street newspaper called Street Roots, which I actually got a couple of copies in the mail the other day from Oregon, Portland, Oregon. I'm going to read this article by Ramona Cowles. Landmark decision by Multnomah County Judge Stephen Gallagher overturns Portland's 19-year-old anti-camping ordinance. I may have read parts of this before, but it's worth listening to. Homeless people in Portland, Oregon have finally received much-needed relief. For 19 years, Portland's anti-camping ordinance made it criminal to sleep outdoors, in public, on private property, or in vehicles, which is pretty much the same, although there are some exceptions in Santa Cruz for private property, but it's actually wider in some respects, Santa Cruz's law. It's even worse because if you sleep in buildings that are not residences, that's criminal behavior. The ordinance was ruled unconstitutional on September 27th in Portland, Oregon, by Multnomah County Judge Stephen Gallagher, who felt it was cruel and unusual punishment. Judge Gallagher found the ordinance to be in violation of the United States Constitution because those without homes are being punished for the status of being homeless. The ordinance was found to be in violation of equal protection and the fundamental right to travel by denying homeless people the opportunity to possess their belongings with them while traveling throughout the city. The case was brought by the state of Oregon against Norman Wicks Sr. and his son Norman Wicks Jr., who had been living in their vehicle, parked nightly at various locations in Portland to sleep. Portland police had, over a short period of time, given the Wicks over 40 citations for camping in their vehicle. Interestingly, it would have been legal for the Wicks to sleep in their truck had they a home to live in, which is not the case in Santa Cruz. This disparity is one of the issues that made Judge Gallagher's ruling possible. Judge Gallagher spoke eloquently and thoughtfully on behalf of homeless people, demonstrating a keen knowledge of the issues faced by homeless people in their daily struggle to survive. Judge Gallagher offered a point-by-point explanation for his ruling. In response to the question whether enforcement of the ordinance constitutes cruel and unusual punishment and is therefore unconstitutional under the Oregon and state U.S. constitutions, Judge Gallagher wrote, "The court finds it impossible to separate the fact of being homeless from the necessary acts that go with it, such as sleeping. The act of sleeping or eating in a shelter away from the elements cannot be considered intentional, avoidable conduct. This conduct is ordinary activity required to sustain life. Due to the fact that they are homeless, persons seek out shelter to perform these daily functions. Yet the city considers this location to be a campsite if the homeless person maintains any bedding." And that is also illegal in Santa Cruz, to maintain bedding. And I believe... yeah, maintaining bedding is considered to be a campsite in Santa Cruz as well. Having bedding nearby immediately available for use is a violation of the blanket ban. And sleeping, of course, is a violation of the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. But continuing with the Portland story, "The homeless are being punished for behavior indistinguishable from the mere fact that they are homeless. Therefore, those without homes are being punished for the status of being homeless. This court does not accept the notion that the life decisions of an individual, albeit seemingly voluntary decisions, necessarily deprive that person of the status of being homeless. Judge Gallagher also found that the ordinance burdens homeless people's fundamental right to travel. The homeless carry their belongings with them or store them in a location to which they have access. Those belongings necessarily include the tools required to participate in the basic necessities of life, bedding for sleeping, and a stove for food preparation. If a homeless person is traveling through our city or traveling within our city looking for work and a permanent place to reside, he is not allowed to remain in his vehicle or lean-to without being in violation of the ordinance. By denying defendants the ability to partake in simple necessities of life, the ordinance restricts their freedom of movement. Homeless choosing to travel throughout our city are not allowed to stop without being in violation. Those homeless who are trying to make a life in this city are in constant violation. In response to the city's argument that homeless people camping pose health and safety damages, Judge Gallagher argued, although protecting the health and safety of the citizens of the city may very well be compelling, there are less restrictive means to address the problem. The Wicks found themselves living out of their car due to their inability to find adequate and affordable housing. Rather than slapping a homeless person with a citation for maintaining life in a public place, the city could first explore avenues of providing sufficient housing for all individuals. Adequate services should also be in place to help individuals find housing and jobs. There are a great number of alternatives regarding housing, job training, mental health services, etc., that should be put in place to both minimize the effect of homelessness and eliminate homelessness altogether before our city resorts to arresting individuals for sleeping and eating in the only locations available to them. Now, you'll often hear a corruption of this argument from people like, Premack or Kennedy, or perhaps even Emily Riley, who are all on our council, city council. We certainly heard it from past city council members that, we want to find avenues for providing sufficient housing for people. We want to help individuals get jobs, get job training, mental health services. But what they don't say is the other side of this argument, which Gallagher has so eloquently said, that unless those services are serving people who are sleeping outside adequately, you cannot arrest people for sleeping. Therefore, you must immediately suspend or eliminate all sleeping bans and other bans on life-sustaining behavior. And, of course, that is something that the politically correct, sensitive to the West Side mentality, pseudo-progressive folks on City Council just can't do. And they will not advocate for it. They are, in fact, advocates for repression of homeless people, because insofar as they continue to maintain the sleeping ban every night, that is repression. Every night, that means homeless people can't sleep in groups safely. They can't sleep in well-lighted areas. They can't use police facilities. Every night, that subjects them to $54 tickets. Now, you may have heard mention of a proposal by Ed Porter, perhaps through Michael Schmidt, when he spoke earlier in our recorded interview about lowering the fine. Well, first of all, there's a question as to how low you can lower the fine, because I think there's maybe a standard imposition of an additional kind of surcharge by the county. So, for example, the fine already is at $20, but you pay $54 because there are two surcharges we found. One was city surcharge, and I think one was a county surcharge, and one was a state surcharge. I'm not quite sure, but there were two additional surcharges that turn a $20 fine into a $50 fine. The actual wording of the ordinance says $20, but it ends up being a $54 ticket for sleeping or covering up with blankets. The second thing is, of course, that when a police officer stops a homeless person for a sleeping ticket, that gives him or her license to search that person completely, to harass them, to move them on to another place where there is no legal place for them to go, to essentially strip them of their dignity and their privacy. And it's in essence a way of saying, homeless people, get out. Don't be here. Go away. And that kind of thing is a form of banishment, which it's not just wrong, it's unconstitutional, it's not considered to be a legitimate remedy in the United States for a crime. I mean, you can give someone a restraining order away from an area, but to banish them from a town, banishment is something that used to be used for some crimes, but it's not considered a legitimate punishment now, and it's certainly completely illegitimate when you're talking about a status of being homeless. So that's always seemed pretty clear to me. And I like to make that distinction of those who like to jabber on about affordable housing, jobs, and all these wonderful services, but at the same time support the sleeping ban. I would just turn to them and say, think again. Think again. Judge Gallagher concluded, individuals without a home must carry what belongings are necessary to survive, such as bedding and food, and with them at all times, and or store them in a place to which they have access. The place where these belongings are kept is by law deemed to be a campsite. Now, that's not entirely true in Santa Cruz, because sometimes you can... call it a campsite area. So it's partially true in Santa Cruz, too, what Judge Gallagher is saying for Portland, Oregon. Every time a homeless person remains at that location, he is in violation. Now, that's not written in the Santa Cruz law, but in fact has turned out to be how police enforce the law on some occasions. When the UCSC police found Doug Cronin at a campsite that wasn't even his campsite, and he was visiting, he was accused of simply by being there of being in criminal violation of the camping ban, and he was convicted by Judge Art Danner. So it's done here, although it's not a part of our law. It's a part of the prejudiced mindset. That's why the law must be struck down, so the mindset cannot be allowed to oppress people. Those whose homes are impermissibly punished for the status of being homeless, those without homes are impermissibly punished for the status of being homeless. Performing such life-sustaining actions as sleeping with bedding is a necessary action for someone without a home. This act of sleeping is not conduct that can be separated from the fact of the individual's status of being homeless. This argument has never been used in a Santa Cruz court, by the way. It might be an effective one. We've simply argued that it's cruel and unusual punishment. It violates, offends basic human decency to tell someone they can't sleep when there are no legal places for them to sleep. Portland's anti-camping ordinance punishes the status of being homeless. Understandably, Mr. Wicks Sr. responded to Judge Gallagher's ruling with elation. It was absolutely necessary to get that mean-spirited law overturned. Don't stereotype those who are homeless. I wanted to do it the right way. I chose not to commit crimes to resolve my situation. I hung on. A lot of people get worn out. I was on the verge of being worn out, but I endured and prayed. My son and I, we have moxie. I would suggest Mayor Vera Katz of Portland be homeless for 2 or 3 months to see what it feels like to not be able to bathe when you need to, change your clothes, go to the restroom, or any of the other normal things that everybody takes for granted. Being homeless is not a crime, and it's demeaning to the police who are forced to spend time they could use to fight real crime to roust homeless people. Mayor Vera Katz needs to leave it alone and accept the defeat. This county, this country, was founded by people who camped, and now we're too good for that. Judge Gallagher made the right decision. With the help of Northwest Pilot Project's JOIN and the generosity of Durham Construction Company, Mr. Wicks Sr. and his son are now housed. Wicks Jr. is now attending school, where he is studying computer technology in a special program that will be followed by a new job in the local computer industry. Expressing his relief, Mr. Wicks commented, "You know what I did last night? I took a bubble bath, just because I could. It felt great." Mayor Vera Katz responded with frustration to Judge Gallagher's ruling, promising to use other violations to continue the city's effort to keep homeless people off the streets. Some of the violations often used to keep homeless people off the streets on the move, to keep homeless people on the move, are trespassing, loitering, and public nuisance. An increase in these kinds of violations could be expected if Mayor Katz's strategy is put into effect. Mayor Katz hopes that the district attorney will appeal the decision and that the ordinance can continue to be enforced until the case is heard again, a process that may take as long as a year. And apparently that was done, and they sounds like they have a different process than California, though I may be misunderstanding our process. My understanding is that if a local judge found the law unconstitutional and it was being appealed, that still enforcement would be suspended until that ruling was overturned. Apparently in Oregon it's the other way, although I'm not sure, and I guess I need more information on that, because unfortunately no local judge has ever found the camping ordinance or even the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance unconstitutional. Pausing briefly for a phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, I was wanting to make an announcement.
Sure.
I just wanted to announce that on Thursday the 14th of December, Todd Nelson Center. There's an event called An Evening in Revolution with a man named Curly Raul Estramera, who's a former Young Lord, former Black Liberation Army member, and a former political prisoner. And he just got back from Cuba and spoke with Assata Shakur and Fidel Castro and a number of others. And he's going to be speaking on that date.
Wow. Okay, is there a number people can call for more info?
Yeah, people can call 831-421-7531.
That's a pager number, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All righty. More information about that?
That should be, I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I think we initially heard about that from Jim Costner earlier in the show. But indeed, if you have any questions about that Thursday program, give a call to 421-7531 and wait for a page back. Continuing this article in Street Roots on the overturning of Portland's camping ordinance. Currently, the camping ordinance, not just the sleeping sections of it, but the entire camping ordinance was found unconstitutional. In fact, I don't think Portland even uses the word sleeping in its ordinance, whereas here in Santa Cruz we do. The decision of some homeless people to remain living outdoors when examined more closely is not a decision to be homeless, but rather a decision to stop headbutting the brick wall of barriers to obtaining a house in a housing market that has no mercy. This ruling may mean the dissolution of some of those barriers. Social service workers who help homeless people find housing are hoping that this will mean that their clients' criminal records will be cleared of anti-camping violations, ironically, one of the many barriers to obtaining housing for their clients. With one of the highest rent averages in the nation, Portland is an inhospitable landscape to people living on fixed incomes or earning low wages. According to the June 1999 multifamily market report by Norris, Beggs, and Simpson, the annual rent for a unit in the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area ranges from $631 to $1,054 a month, well out of reach of disabled people and seniors living on general assistance benefits of $304 a month, or Social Security insurance of $515 a month, and leaves little left over for forgotten veterans living on pensions of $731 a month. Rent at even the lower end of that range is a heavy burden on the $1,040 a month earned before taxes by a single person working full-time at minimum wage. This is one reason so many Oregon households are food-challenged, as reported by Street Roots in November 1999. Examination of a limited amount of available information demonstrates that there are a minimum 4,000 homeless people in Portland, probably a lot more. The nature of homelessness, no stable place where a person can be found and counted, makes it difficult to enumerate. What is clear is that many are forced by necessity to live on the streets, in cars and vans, doubled up with families or friends, or in dangerous situations for lack of alternatives. Many of these people are disabled, elderly, children and youth, veterans, mentally ill, have criminal or eviction records, or are people who face overwhelming barriers to finding permanent affordable housing in an ever-tightening housing market. For most, there are no beds available in Portland area shelters. The night Norman Wicks and his son were cited with a ticket that landed them in court, it was 28 degrees outside, and all the shelters were full. Even a roach-infested flop house in downtown Portland requires background checks of 5 or more years for criminal, rental, credit, and eviction histories. The difficulties of obtaining housing leave many homeless people embittered and hopeless. Despite promises made by the City Council in 1988 to protect the low-income affordable housing stock in downtown Portland, the supply has shrunk by over 26% in the last 10 years, according to the 1999 Downtown Portland Affordable Housing Inventory, produced annually by the Northwest Pilot Project. Conversion to commercial use, demolition, fire, abandonment, or upgrading to expensive housing are listed as the cause of these losses. The city has failed to respond adequately despite the current economic boom and strong local growth and development in other areas. In the report's foreword, Susan Emmons, director of Northwest Pilot Projects, concludes, "We have no general preservation program, we have no funding strategy, and we have no roadmap to get back to the affordable housing levels of 21 years ago. 11 years ago, we made a serious commitment. What are we doing to reachieve our own 1978 level of housing affordable to the poor downtown. The city must become bolder. We must try various housing preservation and development measures, even if they be controversial, and we must raise additional housing funds. Now is the time for courageous leadership on the part of the city council. Now is the time to take our goals seriously. It is clear that Judge Gallagher was listening, even if the city of Portland was not. And that's from the October issue of Street Roots. It's about the September 27th decision of a Portland judge to throw out the entire camping ordinance. And indeed, I believe within the next 5 days, a tent city will be established. Here's a little story by Jack Tafari on that. We need a tent city. Winter will soon be upon us, homeless people, and it is time to begin thinking about getting ourselves a sanctioned campsite. Sleeping in doorways, under bridges, and in parking lots, concealing ourselves in shrubbery and parks and in backyards. This is not so bad on warm, dry summer nights, but shivering all night in a TPI blanket under the marquee of the Guild Theater in February is not nice at all. Seattle has a tent city. Los Angeles had one 14 years ago called Justiceville, and it evolved into Dome Village. Portland needs a tent city now. The missions are not an option for many of us. The missions are crowded and the lines are long. Many of us prefer sleeping on the streets to the sanctimony we often encounter in the missions. Many find the missions too regulated, and New Testament Christianity is not everyone's religion. Not that the missions do not provide some good services. They provide clothing for those who need them. They provide showers, which, though woefully inadequate for those who work, are often the only showers many of us are able to get. And they feed a lot of hungry people. But many of us resent the force-fed, humble piety that often goes along with the meal. Often it seems that the missions create a kind of dependency, a client-provider cycle that many homeless people seem to get stuck in and never seem able to break. A sanctioned campsite would provide a place where we could store our things. It would give us a break from the constant hassle and harassment we get living on the streets. We could regulate our campsite ourselves. Once we had that break, we could go about our business, deal with whatever we have to deal with. It is not easy getting and holding a job when you live on the streets. The respite a campsite would give us would allow us to improve our levity and condition, and would allow some of us to get the steady jobs that would get us up out of homelessness. Street dwellers in India do not push around shopping carts with their belongings in them. They have dharmashalas, campsites, where they keep their things and get on with their lives. It is the same in Rio, where people who would otherwise be homeless have their favelas. On the outskirts of Cape Town in South Africa, people have their crossroads. Homelessness is a third world feature that has attached itself to a developed country, and it is not going away. Other cities in this country have their sanctioned sites. Portland needs a sanctioned tent city now, and so does Santa Cruz. We at Street Roots are just now putting together a campaign for a sanctioned site. Let us capture a piece of fallow ground if necessary and hold it for ourselves, for doesn't the Bible say that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof? We urge all homeless people and activists interested in getting a sanctioned campsite to drop by the Street Roots office or to phone us at 228-5657, area code 503. That's Jack Tafari. We need a camp city, and I believe the two more recent issues of Street Roots, which I have not yet gotten in the mail from Portland, have more details on this planned tent city that will be happening beginning December 15th. I think they're going to move from place to place until the city finally lets them stay in some place, kind of like nomads of old. Well, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your weary host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert. Phone number here, for those of you who want to get in the last 10 minutes, is 427-3772. And looking at the agenda for City Council coming up on Tuesday, I don't have the CPRB agenda, but there is this interesting item in the afternoon agenda, 3 o'clock, about $1.2 million plus $121,000 for the construction of university pumping facilities upgrade. And I think Scott Graham, city council watcher, I call him Scope It Out Scott, he talked about it on the last show. He said that the problem with the huge increase in the water for the campus, it's strange they're making such a vast increase when the campus is supposed to be predicting only a smaller increase in the number of students and faculty. It really encourages them to increase more, and it's something people might want to comment on. It's item 8. It's certainly rather expensive. It's $1.3 million. a lot of different places that could be used. And that was another proposal that came up at the Homeless Working Group, which I encourage people to get involved with. That's every Friday, 3 to 5, at the Holiday Inn in the Chamber of Commerce headquarters. And it's not Chamber of Commerce run by any means, by the way, and that's so be advised of that. But what came up at one of the last meetings was a proposal that City Council dedicate 1 or 2% of its current TOT assessment, that's its transient occupancy tax, to social service homeless stuff. Right now it just goes into the general fund and the City Council uses the money any way it wants. And in fact, that was one of the reasons that Schmidt and other opponents of the, well, businesses and other opponents of the TOT increase opposed it, was because there was no specific dedication of the money to homeless services. Or let's put it this way, that it might be dedicated to homeless services, but they could simply reduce other funding sources significantly and use the money, in essence, have the money which would be voted supposedly for homelessness go into other services. Or it wasn't for homelessness, it was for family shelters, for alleviating homelessness for a certain select creme de la creme of the homeless population. And a very needy part of it, too. I don't want to say that this isn't a required thing. It was just one of these piecemeal, patchwork token gestures by Catherine Byers, which could have been done by the City Council. She could have voted it through last summer. But instead, they made a big brouhaha and turned into a big polarized issue and got defeated. Not by a majority. It was defeated by a minority, but it needed two-thirds at the ballot as Proposition U. So I wonder about that idea, about dedicating a certain amount of money to homeless services every year out of the TOT tax, and then increasing that with an expanded TOT tax. But again, I don't really consider myself an expert on the social services angle of things. I know a human rights violation when I see one, and the sleeping ban is that. And I think most of you out there do too. Well, what have I got left here? We don't have a lot of time. We do have some... I'll be, of course, probably in City Council offices, or somebody will be there tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And who knows, maybe we'll just stir up a little hot coffee for folks who are interested. Here is a letter from Sherry Connable, a woman with whom I've often had disagreements, and no doubt will again. But I liked her letter. I wanted to read it. This was written a year ago, November 4th, 1999, and it was not responded to, so she resubmitted it a year later, November 14th, 2000. Dear council members, as the holiday season approaches, I am reminded of a situation we have faced in the past relative to the treatment of homeless and poor people downtown. I wrote to the council about this just 2 years ago in 1997, and I am writing once again. At that time, I had been really embarrassed to see police officers and hosts going up and down Pacific Avenue during rainstorms and forcing homeless and poor people out from under alcoves and overhangs and into the rain, particularly ones who were soliciting donations with a sign. They were told they had to panhandle in the rain itself or they would be ticketed and perhaps go to jail. At the same time, more well-to-do-looking shoppers who had taken refuge from the rain, even in violation of the distance elements of the downtown ordinances, were not bothered. It is quite clear that there was a directive to law enforcement personnel to do this, one of many ways, I suppose, to get unwanted folks out of the downtown. Karen Gillette confirmed that it seemed to be a policy, and it happened again last year in 1998 as well. And, of course, this letter was written a year ago. In my experience, officers on the beat do not set priorities. They are told what to focus on. This begs the question, where are such orders coming from? I do not think I was ever more ashamed to be a resident of Santa Cruz than during that half hour, as I watched how some very poor and fragile people were being treated. And the irony of the juxtaposition could not be missed. Here we are, celebrating the birth of the Prince of Peace, of one who came to teach, above all, that we are each other's keepers, that we are called to do unto others as we would do unto ourselves. Yet the very opposite was in play. The action was cruel and unnecessary, and also health-endangering. I went over to commiserate with one man in particular, who had been in Santa Cruz for many years and is disabled. He was standing in the downpour where he was told he had to be, with a little umbrella, his lower legs and feet getting completely soaked. And though we have often exchanged a word, he simply stared at the ground and would not acknowledge me, obviously too ashamed. So my request to you is that you make it clear to law enforcement personnel at whatever level it needs to happen that this kind of law enforcement behavior will not take place this year, that it in fact will be actively discouraged. I guess the alternative, if it is to be deemed absolutely important, would be to treat all violators equally, including the better-to-do-looking shoppers, and move them out into the rain as well. It is but one example, though a particularly unsettling one, of the ways that the downtown ordinances are continually used in a selective way to harass certain kinds of folks. It needs to be stopped. It hurts and defiles our community in a very encompassing and disturbing way. During this season, we honor not only Christmas, but also Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, and the solstice, among other holidays. All emphasize caring for each other, treating all of creation with respect, and bringing light and love into the world. May we keep these ideals in front of us in each choice we make during the final days of the 20th century, and for those who believe this is the last year of the second millennium, that's still where we are, especially in our treatment of some folks whose lives are already quite fragile and in need of support. I would truly appreciate your thoughts and response. Sincerely, Sherry Connable. And she includes another letter from a year before, which talks about John Dine and the shooting there, and also the people being driven from under the eaves. And finally, on November 15th, she filed a complaint with the police department about how police treated a woman, and actually who was beaten. And we talked about this on the air, a woman named Norma Jean. And this is Sherry's letter. I brought this incident to the CPRB on November 13th. At their request, I'm filing a third-party complaint, which I did not know was possible. On November 12th and 13th, four different people who witnessed the police response to the incident on November 9th approached me. They were quite upset and wanted to relate what happened. Their version were all quite similar, and they then checked their story with Wayne, the eyewitness to the attack, who also became a victim when he tried to interfere. I then had second conversations with each person and believe the story is largely true. None of these folks were willing to formally get involved for fear of police reprisal. On November 9th, Norma Jean, N.J., was accosted by an ex-boyfriend in front of the Palace Arts store, the old one. He was drunk, highly belligerent, and immediately began an assault. Wayne, the only other person present, tried to intervene and was also hit twice when he intervened. So-and-so was able to move away by... It's a little bit illegible here. By that time, her nose... Norma Jean was able to move away. By that time, her nose was broken, one eye a pool of blood, later needing eight stitches, one whole side of her head was swollen black and blue. 911 was dialed. I am not sure who. And a medic and six or seven officers responded. The assailant had fled. Other folks, the ones above, who often spent time at this location, had by then gathered. Two reported that when the officers first arrived, one or two said, "Oh, it's her," in a very snide, demeaning way. The medics attended to her, and the officers collected information. All the folks there, including Wayne, knew the assailant and where he generally hangs out. Three different spots in the downtown area. One offered to go with the officers to find him. His first name was mentioned, I think, Greg or Craig, and one officer said, "Oh, you mean Greg so-and-so," and filled in his last name, so he obviously knew him. What ensued was a conversation initiated by one officer in which at least two or three others participated about where to go for dinner. Apparently, Jeffries was high on the list. They then said something like, "Maybe we'll look for him later," and went off for dinner. Two people said to me something like, "There they were, hosing her blood off the sidewalk. We were telling them where to find Greg, and all they talked about was where to go for dinner." What was apparent to me was that all the folks who witnessed the police response felt like that they were disrespectful, flippant, and not taking it seriously from the first, "Oh, it's her," comment to the dinner discussion. I see two problems. One, the general attitude of dismissal and not counting or mattering toward homeless people, which hurts and enrages them justifiably so. Obviously, entitlement to professional help should not be based on status. Two, the lack of pursuit endangering further the public safety. People knew where this man might be. He is known to be violent when drunk. He had just put one person in the hospital, assaulted another, and fled. Under these circumstances, one would think immediate pursuit and apprehension would be expected. Certainly, if this had happened at some middle-class home, there would be immediate pursuit where the whereabouts were known. This was a dangerous person on the loose. I was also told by Wayne, the eyewitness, interviewer, and secondary victim, that as officers were leaving, they said, If you see him, the assailant later, dial 911 and we will pick him up. About a half hour later, Wayne walked up to one of the locations where this man hangs out, saw him, and did dial 911. He was apprehended and was on probation for assault and battery already. One positive thing was that when Wayne called 911, they asked him to stay where he was and that they would call back, and let him know that when the assailant had been detained. The 911 operator did follow through on this to protect Wayne's safety. I want to say again that none of these people want to be part of a complaint process at this point or identified. They feel that they are too vulnerable and at the risk of revenge from the police. Wayne was already interviewed by the police. I also found out by appearance which officer led the dinner conversation, though I do not know his name. When they described him to me, I know who it is. Thank you for your time, Sherry Connable. That's another one of those file and forget complaints that is going to the Citizens Police Review Board, which indeed meets tomorrow. And if you want to talk to the Police Review Board about that complaint, you can bring it up during their oral communications period at 5:30 at City Hall. That is an option you have. On another note, I got some very interesting documentation from the city risk manager about which police officers, I should say, which victims of police officers have recovered money from the city for damages by the police department. And I'm hoping that with a little work, as I mentioned in the last show, if anybody's interested in this, we can track down who the offending police officers are and begin looking more closely at their records, because it's all very well to try to track down complaints. What you really want to do is follow the money trail here. Where the city feels it's necessary to give away money, there you have, I think, a very probable serious violation, and that is worth pursuing. And along those lines, here's a little nostalgia while we wait for the little red hen to show up. 1994, of course, was the year when Scott Kennedy, our new council member, was mayor, and Scott Kennedy helped put through the downtown ordinances. And originally, the downtown ordinances said you can't sit anywhere on any sidewalk on the sidewalk downtown, generally speaking. In consequence, police began to arrest people who sat down eating food on the sidewalk around the Food Not Bombs feeding area, which in those days was at Cathcart and Pacific, right across from Johnny's Sportswear, I guess it is. And in response to those arrests, the next week, people showed up in some numbers to challenge that. Literally, hundreds of people came, and the police rioted. They broke one man's ribs. They caused another woman to miscarry, something which Scott Kennedy, as far as I know, ignored entirely, did not carry through on any of the complaints against the police, and essentially defended the police behavior and attacked the protesters because it was, of course, his ordinances that they were enforcing, that the police were enforcing. Let's hear a little from those ancient days when there actually were a massive number of protesters on the streets.
Talking to people, asking them to get up.
Abbott. Now, this officer is asking again, do you feel intimidated when the situation happens?
No, I'm not really intimidated.
Would you like to speak?
Yes, sir.
Would you like to speak up on this podium?
Sure. I'll be arrested if I do.
All right. Well. Would you like to go first or me? I'll speak right after you, right before you. I don't care.
Okay. Hey, David. David Grace with a video camera. The officers are demanding that a man get off the obelisk, that is to say, the pipe box. But Janelle continues to sit steadfast with a sign that says, "Who owns the sidewalk?" Paul Brindell is also photographing proceedings, and we have a sign with Robert Lee, "Two faces of Scott Kennedy abroad, ban the bomb, at home, ban the bombs." So there we are.
Why do these people have to stand the wall?
Here we have Stewart and Tom Schreiner are still sitting down. Police are conferring as to whether to arrest these dangerous sit criminals. How can sitting be stamped out in Santa Cruz? That is the question at hand, folks. Mr. Brindell? To scoff law and sit on the sidewalk. The whole thing is disgraceful. Look at this abuse of city property. I'm shocked, shocked and dismayed. Kim, I'll do this fix.
They have to give you a warning before giving you a ticket. If you decide to sit on the sidewalk, it's an infraction. The most that you can get is a fine or community service at worst. But we are fighting these in court because we think it's just insane to give people tickets for sitting on the sidewalk. So again, if you're sitting on the sidewalk, they have to give you a warning. You can get up and nothing happens to you. If you want to stay seated, they'll give you a ticket. They'll probably arrest you, bring you to the court, bring you to the county jail department, give you a ticket. The worst that can happen is a fine or community service. Do you have the money? Community service at worst. We have a right to sit on the sidewalk. Don't let them clear you off.
Arrest. Sign a legal paper. Sign this legal stuff so that we can support you in jail. Also, the legal phone number is 454-0935 if you haven't already written it down. Write it down on your arm if you're thinking of risking arrest so you can call us when you're in jail.
What's that number?
What's the number, Anders?
454-0935.
Please come and write your name and phone number down so we can make sure that you get out of jail safe and everything.
Well, but then they have to stand up.
Is there a log yet? Waiting on your game?
Hey, everybody! Thank you for coming! They're going to have a hell of a time arresting everybody here. I am advised by my legal advisor, Linda Edwards, who is the only person who has two sitting tickets. She tells me, keep a passageway so people can walk through, so the cops don't have an excuse. That's her advice. Linda is the only person who has two tickets for sitting on the sidewalk. Under the new law, two tickets means up to 6 months in jail. Yes, you heard me right. 6 months in jail for two tickets.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're stunning in the world. line.